This week's Torah portion is Naso, and it begins in Numbers chapter 5, if you want to get ready to turn there, Naso. And we're going to try to cover this material here in about 30, 35 minutes. We'll see how I do. I'm used to teaching up until I hear a bell ring. If I don't hear that bell ring, then I don't know. Somebody needs to imitate the sound of a school bell. Here you go. We need an authorized bell ringer. Today we're going to talk about one of my favorite characters in the Bible, and that is Numbers chapter 5, verse 21 is where we're going to start off with this week's Torah portion. This character Paul, a.k.a. Shaul or Saul, and we're going to look at this question. This is kind of our overarching question for today's teaching. Is Paul a false prophet, or is he still falsely accused? And we're going to answer that question because there's people who, even in our realm, in the kind of fringy side of things, that believe that Paul is a false prophet, that he tried to create a new religion and lead people into that. That's Torahlessness. That's against the faith of the Jews at the time. And I'm going to prove to you today that that's not the case, that he was absolutely in the right. And we're going to look at his life a little bit. But I want to talk about...
When they teach the highest foundation... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Posey,
yep.
They have 2 weeks just on Paul the Misunderstood.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of new research that's coming out about Paul that's putting in the proper context.
Good.
Ted and Karen have asked me to deconstruct a porch for them. I didn't want to put a picture up their deck without permission, but
that's what our house looks like right now.
But this is their house. Yeah. No, this is not this is not Ted and Karen's house.
They don't have air conditioning.
Yeah. But they've asked me to deconstruct. So all this week I've been working on deconstructing their back deck. And it's a huge deck. It's like the size of this room. You know, it's a really big deck. And I learned a lot about the deconstruction process because normally I'm on the other end of that. I'm usually building something. So I'm deconstructing this deck for them. And I'm realizing my first couple days I spent just trying to figure out the best and most efficient way to deconstruct this deck for them. Because I went one way, I had this one tool, and that didn't work, it took too long, and it was exhausting me, or, you know, I switched up a little bit. And it wasn't until about the third day that I figured out a system and a routine. Okay, now I got a good system, I got a plan down, and I was like zipping through it and deconstructing this deck that was built really well. The guy did a really good job in building it. But the deconstruction process is interesting because do you guys think that I'm using a tape measure much? I'm not using it at all. I actually just left it at home. I'm using, you know, things like a skill saw, a sawzall, a pry bar, a hammer. I'm using things that are going to be kind of destructive, right? And I'm not going to be doing things that are very precision-oriented. I'm not using a pencil or anything like that or speed square. My tools are completely different. When I deconstruct something, I'm not worried about precision as much as I'm just worried about getting it out of the way and moving it and making things loose so I can break them, you know? And sometimes when we come into this walk and into the messianic faith, we have to deconstruct some things that were built up in us throughout our lifetime. Whether it be, for me, I grew up in the Assemblies of God denomination, and my dad was an Assemblies of God pastor. Some it might be Southern Baptist, Catholic, some it might be agnosticism or atheism or whatever the case may be. You have a worldview and someone has constructed that worldview in your mind for you, and it takes a little bit of deconstruction. Now, what I am doing as I'm deconstructing their deck is I'm pulling boards out and I'm looking at that board and I'm asking a question about that board. Is this board salvageable? Is this piece of wood reusable? And I have two different piles right now. It's just kind of a big mess, but I will be sorting it out. Here's the usable pile and here's the non-usable pile. And what do I do with the non-usable pile? Well, our intent is to burn that pile of non-usable wood that's rotted beyond usability. So as we do that, as we begin to kind of deconstruct some understanding, some presuppositions about people in the Bible, we have to ask ourselves that question. What is salvageable? What's not salvageable? Because I've heard some things about Paul. You know, maybe they're true, maybe they're not true. For instance, how many of you were taught in your childhood that Paul experienced a name change? Raise your hand if you've heard it. Okay, most people, if not everybody in this room, just raise their hand. They were taught that Paul's name got changed, maybe on the road to Damascus or something like that. You are now called Paul. Christian man, you know, and then Paul went and he shaved his beard off, you know, and he got rid of his kippah if he was wearing one. And he got a part-time job at Lifeway Christian bookstores or something like that, right? And he started teaching Sunday school class or something. But that's not the case, right? Paul always had two names, and he was always a very strict, observant, Pharisaical Jew. always faithful to the Torah, and I'll prove that to you here today. But let's look at Numbers chapter 6, because we're going to look at this weird thing in this week's Torah portion called the Nazarite vow. Numbers chapter 6, verse 1. Adonai said to Moshe, tell the people of Israel, when either a man or a woman makes a special kind of a vow, the vow of a Nazir, consecrating himself to Adonai, he is to abstain from wine and any other intoxicating drink or liquor. He's not to drink vinegar from either source. He is not to drink grape juice. He's not to eat grapes or raisins. As long as he remains a Nazir, he is to eat nothing derived from the grapevine, not even the grape skins or the seeds. Throughout the period of his vow as a Nazir, he is not to shave his head until the end of the time for which he has consecrated himself to Adonai. He is to be holy. He is to let the hair on his head grow long. And throughout the period for which he has consecrated himself to Adonai, he is not to approach a corpse. He is not to make himself unclean for his father, mother, brother, or sister when they die. Since he is consecrated to Adonai on his head, throughout the time of his being a Nazir, he is to be holy for Adonai. If someone next to him dies very suddenly, so that he defiles his consecrated head, then he is to shave his head on the day of his purification. He is to shave it on the seventh day. On the eighth day, he is to bring two doves and two young pigeons to the Kohen at the entrance of the tent of meeting. The Kohen is to prepare one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering and thus make atonement for him, inasmuch as he sinned because of the dead person. That same day, he is to reconsecrate his head. He's basically to start over. He is to consecrate to Adonai the full period of his being a Nazir by bringing a male lamb in its first year as a guilt offering. The previous days will not be counted because his consecration became defiled. This is the law for the Nazir. When his period of consecration is over, he is to be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, where he will present the offering to Adonai. Here's what he's to present to Adonai as an offering, by the way. One male lamb in its first year without defect as a burnt offering. One female lamb in its first year without defect as a sin offering. One ram without defect as a peace offering. A basket of matzah, loaves made of fine flour mixed with olive oil, unleavened wafers spread with olive oil, their grain offering and their drink offerings. The Kohen is to bring them before Adonai, offer his sin offering, his burnt offering, and his ram as a sacrifice of a peace offering to Adonai with the basket of matzah. The Kohen will also offer the grain offering and drink offering that will go with a peace offering. The Nazir will then shave his head at the entrance to the tent of meeting, take the hair removed from his consecrated head, and put it on the fire under the sacrifice of peace offerings. When the ram has been boiled, the Kohen is to take its shoulder, one loaf of the matzah from the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and place them in the hands of the Nazir, and after he has shaved his consecrated head. The Kohen is to wave them as a wave offering before Adonai. This is set aside for the Kohen, along with the breast for waving and the raised up thigh. Following that, the Nazir may drink wine. So in other words, the Kohen's going to eat this. It's not just going to get thrown out or anything like that. This is the law for the Nazir who makes a vow and for his offering to Adonai for his being a Nazir, in addition to anything more for which he has sufficient means. In keeping with whatever vow he makes, he must do it according to the law for the Nazir. So the Nazirite vow is a very interesting vow. It's almost like if you want to be, I don't know, like a special Israelite, like a Jedi Israelite or something, you know, like you're really consecrated, you're really set apart. Here it is in Hebrew, number 6:2, if you want to follow along here. Daber el b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children, the sons of Israel. Ve'amarta elehem, and say to them, ish o isha, if a man or a woman, a isha, ki yafli lin dor, and that's if he wants to make a vow, Nedor, if he wants to bring a vow, like make a vow of a Nazir. You see the first word in red there is Nazir. Leha-zir. You see that? That's the same word. It's the same root word as Nazir. So he's making a Nazir vow that he is consecrated, or Nazir. And I think the root is Nazar, to Adonai. But that's what that word looks like there. To be consecrated is to be a Nazir. It also comes from the word untrimmed vines. So you can kind of take that and run with it however you want. Leviticus 25:5 and Leviticus 25:11. I just took a screenshot of these different translations here. But it uses the word Nazir as a untrimmed vine. So you can kind of figure out why untrimmed vine, maybe uncut hair, untrimmed vine, something. You can kind of piece that together. But it also comes from the word crown. Nazir is a crown. So, you know, like the hair on his head is a crown, you know, and the untrimmed vines are uncut, the hair is uncut. So you can kind of piece that together however you want. But let's take a summary of the prohibitions of a Nazarite. So if you want to take a Nazarite vow tomorrow, here's what you can and cannot do. That a Nazarite should let his hair grow long, that he or she, right, because it can be a female, should not cut his hair long throughout the time of his Nazarite vow, that a Nazarite should not drink wine nor a mixture of wine, not even vinegar coming from wine, that he not eat fresh grapes, that he not eat raisins, that he not eat grape seeds, that he not eat grape peels, that he not enter a shelter where a corpse is located, that he not contact impurity because of a corpse, that he shave his skin and bring it, that should be hair, I don't know why skin, that would hurt, his offerings when he completes his Nazarite vow or when he becomes impure. Okay? So you kind of got a summary of what a Nazarite, and obviously Jewish law is rich with traditions and fleshes out how one is to carry this vow. Jewish law has put a 30-day minimum on the Nazarite vow. So if you wanted to take a Nazarite vow and you go up to the priest and you say, I want to take a Nazarite vow and do it for 1 week, they would say declined, denied. It has to be 30 days or more. So you can go to Nazarite vow and you go to the Kohen and say, I want to take a Nazarite vow, I want to do it for 60 days. They would say, okay, that's fine. You have to fulfill the whole 60 days. But if you touch a dead corpse or a corpse of any kind, in that 60-day period, then you have to start over and you have to restart your whole 60 days. You can be a Nazarite for 3 years, 7 years, as long as you feel like led to do that. A Nazarite vow could be taken by both men and women, by the way. A person can become a Nazarite whether or not the temple is in Jerusalem. Okay? There's no temple right now. Can you take a Nazarite vow? Yes. But you can't end your Nazarite vow because there's no temple to end it in. Your Nazarite vow has to be ended in the temple. All right. So if you do a Nazarite vow now, you're stuck as a Nazarite. Okay. All right. You gotta have some long hair. You're gonna look like you could join a Van Halen or something. Here's how you complete your vow. At the end of the Nazarite vow, the Nazarite brings 3 sacrificial offerings to the temple in Jerusalem. We read that, right? And in addition, some matzah and some flour, right? But 3 living animals have to be sacrificed at the end of your vow. The first is a ewe for a chatat, or a sin offering, right? And the rabbis are kind of like, why is he bringing a sin offering? The rabbis kind of talk, we're not going to get into that today, but the rabbis think, well, why should they not take a Nazarite vow? Because they're bringing a sin offering. Maybe this is a sinner who's turned and repentant and now wants to be a Nazarite. So there's all kinds of conversations you can find on that. After bringing the sacrificial offerings, the Nazarites would shave their heads in the outer courtyard of the temple. Part of the Nazir's commencement offering is given to the Kohen, and this gift is listed as one of the 24 Kohanic gifts that are given to the Kohanim. All right? This is, Where's Jim? There he is. This is back in the 1980s. You would have business in the front, Nazarite in the back. For those who don't get it, I'm going to pause here and let you mull it over.
Oh, man.
Okay, all right. So.
We can't wait.
Well, remember when she was talking about Rebecca, right?
Yeah.
Going on the camel?
Yeah.
Remember when she sees Yitzhak, what happens? She falls off the camel, right? She's the first one to be slain in the spirit.
Uh-oh. So let's ask this question. Now that you know what a Nazarite is and what they can and cannot do, does anyone know or can name some Nazarites that were Nazarites from birth?
Samson
was one.
Yeah.
But who said it?
Samuel
said it. Yes, Samuel was one. Any others? Yeah.
John
who?
Baptist.
Yeah, John the Baptist. Yeah. Anybody else? Ooh. Good. You got who? Who said it? Yeah. Somebody sitting around my dinner table listening. Okay, we're gonna talk about Joseph in a second. Lifetime Nazarites. There's 2 main, and you guys got them right off the bat. 2 examples of Nazarites in the Hebrew Bible are Samson, Judges 13, and Samuel. Both were born previously barren mothers and entered into their vows through either their mother's oath, in the case of Hannah, or divine command, in the case of Samson, rather than by their own volition. Isn't that interesting? They have those things in common. These vows required Samson and Samuel to live devout lives, yet in return, they received extraordinary supernatural gifts. Samson possessed strength and ability in physical battle against the Philistines, whereas Samuel was given the ability to prophesy. Interesting. He began a prophet. But look at the differences between the two. Yeah. Samson was led by his passions, right? And he's a very physical man. And you remember, like, he's a Nazarite. And where does he find this honey? He's hungry and he's coming across this dead corpse, right?
Unkosher animal.
Yeah, and he gets wild honey out of this thing and eats it. No, 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 you shouldn't do that, right? You're a Nazirite. And also he takes this wife, not a kosher wife, right? And he's doing all these things. He's led by his passions as a man, right? But he has this physical strength, very physical guy. But then look at Samuel. It's almost the opposite,
yeah.
Right? He's not at the forefront. A lot of his life, most of his life, he's kind of just in the background of his life. And he's very passionless. You know, like Samson has a lot of unbridled passion, whereas Samuel, he's not going to live that down for a long time. Samuel is a man who's kind of more level-headed, and he's not physically oriented. He's spiritually oriented, and he sees into the spiritual realm. And he, you know, many times he says to someone, if you do this, this will happen to you, right? And he's wiser. He's given the opportunity to anoint again. He's given the ability to prophesy. He's given a spiritual gift, spiritual superpower, if you want to call it that. I thought it's interesting to compare the two. Maybe we're supposed to do that.
He did have passion one time.
Yeah, yeah, he did.
He hacked the king to death.
Yeah. He got triggered. We said, someone said Joseph, and Sophie said Joseph, and she's right. Joseph was called a Nazir. And if you don't believe me, go to Deuteronomy 33:16. I should have put it up here in the slide. But it calls him a Nazir. Now, what do your translations say in Deuteronomy 33:16? Somebody tell me. Just read it out loud. We need to do sword drills to get you guys faster. Remember sword drills? Yeah, good. Should do those.
33:16.
Yes, you got it.
And for the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, and for the good will of him that dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren.
That top of the head there is the Nazir. He calls him a Nazir. Does anybody have anything different?
The crown.
Okay, he calls it the crown. He's a crown among his brothers, maybe some of your translations say. That word there, huh?
ESV says crown.
Okay, that word there is a Nazir. So he's like a Nazir for his brothers. So I thought it was interesting. And here you guys got this one too. Luke 1:13-15. John the Baptist was a Nazirite, a lifetime Nazirite. All right? So go to Luke 1:13 and you can kind of prove it. Where am I getting this from? I'll read a little bit of it. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Luke 1:13. Luke 1 is a long chapter, isn't it? But the angel said to him, said to Zechariah, don't be afraid, Zechariah, because your prayer has been heard. Your wife, Elisheva, will bear you a son, and you are to name him Yochanan. He will be a joy and a delight to you, and many people will rejoice when he is born. For he will be a great in the sight of Adonai. He is to never drink wine or other liquor, and he will be filled with the Ruach HaKodesh from his mother's womb. Interesting. So there's some components of being a Nazirite in John's life as well.
You know that statement right there about rejoicing at his birth, that is almost prophetic, because we know later Miriam got the baby in her womb leaping.
Yeah.
And she's not, and he isn't even born yet either. And just the fact that he's there.
That's a good point. I'm going to submit to you today that our friend Paul took a Nazirite vow as well. And I'm going to submit that there's a possibility that he took it two different times, actually. Go with me to Acts 18. This is the weaker of the two that I have a harder time proving. But Acts 18, verse 18.
18:18?
Yes, 18:18. It says, Shaul remained for some time. Then he said goodbye to the brothers and sailed off to Syria. And after cutting his hair short in Cenchrea, I hope I'm saying that right, because he had taken a vow with him were Priscilla and Aquila. So why did he cut his hair? And what's this vow? The only thing you connect maybe is a Nazirite vow that would require him to cut his hair. But what's the problem with this, though?
No
he's not at the temple. He's not ending it in the proper place. So that's a little bit problematic. We can't really prove that he took a Nazarite vow in Acts 18 because he's ending it seemingly in the wrong place. But if we go to another chapter, Acts chapter 21, I have better proof. Let me figure out where we want to start here. Let's go to verse 17. In Jerusalem, the brothers received us warmly. The next day, Saul and the rest of us went into James or Yaakov. Now, James here is the leader of the sect known as the Way. He is the main dude. He's the head honcho at this point, okay? And all the elders were present. After greeting them, Shaul, Paul, described in detail each of the things God had done among the Gentiles through his efforts. On hearing it, they praised God because they said to him, "You see, brother, how many tens of thousands of believers there are among the Jews, and they are all realizing that Jesus nailed the law to the cross." No, they're all zealots for the Torah. Whoa, wait a second. And they're praising God for that. Now, that would be a good opportunity if I was Paul. I'd be like, wait a second. Okay, wait. Don't you realize that all that's going back to bondage, you know? That's going back into legalism. You're abandoning the grace of Messiah. Does he do that? Now, what they have been told about you is that you are teaching, now this is James talking to Paul, that you are teaching all the Jews living among the Gentiles to apostatize from Moshe, or from the Torah, telling them not to have Brit Milah, or circumcision, for their sons, and to not follow the traditions. Uh-oh, I said the T word. So here's another good opportunity. Let's give Paul a second opportunity to say, oh, actually, that is what I am doing. Have you read my letter, Galatians? You know, that would be a great opportunity for Paul to be like, okay, guys, actually, I have something to tell you. I am teaching people, you know, leave the tutor and go to Messiah. That was just to bring us to Messiah. Don't go back to that. I am teaching people that. I didn't realize that was the wrong thing to do. You know, maybe Paul could apologize here and admit to his wrongdoing or whatever the case may be. Or he could get in debate with them and try to prove to them how the Torah has been done away with and nailed to the cross or whatever the case may be. Does he do that?
No.
Here's what he says. He says, "What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. So do what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them with you, be purified with them, and pay the expenses connected to them having their head shaved. Then everyone will know that there is nothing to these rumors which they have heard about you, but that on the contrary, you yourself stay in line with keeping the Torah." So there's our third opportunity for Paul to be like, whoa, wait a second. I got to take a vow and I got to pay for four other guys to do it. Remember, how many animals are we talking about here?
Three.
So Paul's got to bring three. Then he's got to pay for 12 more. That's 15 animals that Paul's got to sponsor. And that's just the animals. Now we got to add in the matzah and the flour and, you know, everything else.
Expensive.
This would have been probably months worth of wages for Paul. A perfect opportunity for Paul to clear up a misunderstanding about his teaching right here. Because now he's got to shell out some cash. So if I were Paul and I was, you know, teaching Galatians how, or writing Galatians and intending Galatians to be understood how majority of Christianity understands the book of Galatians, I would say, actually, hold on a second. Because I disagree with that. But does he do that? It says the next day, verse 26, the next day Shaul took them in. Uh-oh. So he's going along with this. He's wanting to bed down these rumors. He agrees that these are false rumors. He took them in. He purified himself along with them. And he entered into the temple to give notice of when the period of purification would be finished. And when some unbelieving Jews from the province of Asia saw him in the temple, they stirred up a crowd and they grabbed him. They said, "Men of Israel, help," they shouted. "This is the man who goes everywhere teaching everyone the things against the people, against the Torah, and against this place." Is that true?
No.
Those are false accusations, right? All of them. And now he's even brought some Gentiles into the temple and defiled this place. Is that true?
No.
No, because they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him and assumed that Shaul had brought him into the temple. And the whole city was in an uproar. So we see Paul here agreeing to take a Nazirite vow, but also paying for and sponsoring four other guys to do it. Interesting. So let's ask this question. This is Solomon's colonnade last week.
And these other four men were Jewish.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was unfounded.
Yeah, you had to be a Jew to take the Nazirite vow. Gentiles could not take
that.
Exactly. So all of them are false accusations.
Okay.
But this is the temple here, and you know, so this is the Antonia Fortress where the Roman legion, I guess, would have been stationed. Right here, Antonia Fortress.
And at one point, that's where Yeshua was.
Yeah. So the crowd's going to get stirred up. Paul's going to get grabbed by the Roman soldiers there overseeing, because they sit up here and they watch everything that's going on right here. Because if a riot's going to break out, if a revolution's going to start, if a rebellion's going to start, it's going to be somewhere in this 36-acre plateau called the Temple Mount. Okay? So they're up here and they're watching everything that's going on. And they see this riot begin. And so what do? They sweep in, they grab Paul, and they yank him out, and they grab him, they take him to the Antonia Fortress, and it's there, they're like, what is going on? Why are these people trying to kill you? Who are you? You know? And they begin to question him. And then he explains, and he makes his defense there. But before he does, he even turns around on the steps of the Antonia Fortress, maybe here or something, and he begins to make his defense there on the steps of the Antonia Fortress. And you can read that later in Acts. But I wanted to give you visually what it may have looked like. And as proof, because people will come at you and say, well, Paul wasn't taking a Nazirite vow. It was a different vow, okay? But I just grabbed a few quick screenshots from books. This is from Pentecost to Patmos. This is like a college textbook. But it just goes through, yeah, he's taking a Nazirite vow. I'm going to summarize it for you. He took a Nazirite vow, but he's doing it because Paul is just trying to be a Jew for Jews and a Gentile for Gentiles, in other words. And this book, that's Pentecost of Patmos. Here's one, the Book of Acts in the first century setting, by Brian Rapsk. And he says, while we have no explicit indication of Paul's financial resources in Tarsus, the implicit evidence suggests that they were significant. He appears to have been a man of means in the Jerusalem context as well. On his return to Jerusalem, James and the elders of the church suggest that he personally assist four Jewish Christians in fulfilling their Nazirite vows. So there, the author is saying, this is definitely a Nazirite vow. And the vast majority of scholarship will say that this is a Nazirite vow. Okay, this would demonstrate Jewish loyalties to a suspicious Jewish Christian church, which is kind of an anachronistic thing to say.
Yeah.
To pay a Nazirite's expenses expressed great piety. Significant examples can be found in Alexander Janaeus, who yielded to the encouragements of Simon ben Shita and paid the expenses of 150 Nazirites.
Wow.
Agrippa I, at the celebration of his accession in 41, also showed his piety in this way. The individual who paid the vow incurred a considerable expense. Paul must, therefore, have had considerable personal means in Jerusalem with which to render such assistance. So, essentially, speculation. This is Christians on the Move. Here's what they say. One of the main reasons Paul has returned to Jerusalem is to deliver the collection taken by the Gentile churches in Greece and Asia to help the needy in the city. In Romans 15:31, Paul had expressed his concern that the Jerusalem elders would receive it unfavorably, asking the believers to pray that I might be kept safe from the unbelievers in Judea, and that the contribution I take to Jerusalem may be favorably received by the Lord's people there. Strangely, Luke is almost completely silent on the matter. Whatever the elders' feelings on the collection, they greet Paul warmly when he arrives, and they praise God when they hear the report about his work among the Gentiles. But then, almost immediately, they make a request of him. It appears that many of the believers in Jerusalem are still suspicious of Paul and believe that he's encouraging Jewish believers in Gentile areas to abandon the customs of Judaism. To prove to these believers that Paul is on the up and up, the elders ask him to sponsor four men in taking a Nazirite vow and take part in the purification rites which Paul agrees to do, okay? So there's just, there's gobs and gobs of historians and theologians that agree that this is a Nazirite vow.
It's also believed that he did come from a very wealthy family because when he lays out his credentials later, in order for him to have had that level of scholarship, that was privately paid for.
Yeah, it's very possible.
And so for him to have sat under Gamaliel and some of these other greats, the only way he could have done that was to have had a very wealthy
had some resources,
family
that
could afford to pay for that.
You ever want? No? Just fly. Okay. When did these events in Acts 21 occur? What year? Take a guess. Everybody? Let me ask you this. What came first, this event or the writing of Galatians? Or the writing of Romans? Or what came first, you think? Because here's the thing. Maybe if we could prove that this came first in Acts 21 and he goes up to take Nazarite vow, if we could prove that came first, then maybe we can say, okay, maybe his theology was evolving a little bit. And maybe by the time he wrote Galatians much, much later, maybe he was kind of over all that Jewish stuff and was the Lifeway Christian bookstore employee, you know, and was the good Christian Sunday school teacher, right? Can we do that?
No.
Why not? Let me ask you this question before I answer that question. What is the most commonly considered to be Paul's most anti-Torah epistle?
Galatians.
Definitely Galatians, right? Galatians. When was it written? A majority of scholars agree that it was written between the 40s, the late 40s and the early 50s. So we got a window of about 8 to 10 years maybe in there. Late 40s to early 50s. Maybe more like 5 to 6 years that Paul wrote the book of Galatians.
The temple was still standing.
And the temple was still standing.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did the Acts 21 take place? When did Paul take a Nazarite vow? He didn't take it till 59, possibly 60 A.D. So we're looking at 10, even as far as 20 years after his writing of the book of Galatians, does he take a Nazarite vow? And it's confusing sometimes because we see the book of Acts in our Bibles, and then Galatians comes much later in our Bibles, right? So we think that's chronological, is how it's laid out in our Bibles. That's not true. Because, let me show you a graph here in a second. So how many animals would be offered by Paul and these four other guys? We established how many? 15 by the four, 3 by Paul. So he'd be paying for 15 animals to be sacrificed. How much money would this cost Paul? Probably in today's standards, in today's currency, thousands of dollars, if I had to guess. Does he say yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, I'll do it. Here's a good chart. I like this chart. It shows the timeline of the books of in the New Testament, when they were written. We got the book of Acts. And the book of Acts is more of a history book within which is inserted all these epistles by Paul. So all these epistles are happening within the book of Acts, okay? And it's important that we think about the book of Acts that way, that it wasn't Acts all happened and then Paul writes letters, but rather Acts is happening in the midst of that Paul is writing letters. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So Galatians actually is the very first epistle written right here in the late 40s, early 50s. And then the events of Acts 21 are going to happen here, like 10, 15, 20 years later, right? What's different? So we can't just kind of, dismiss this event as being, well, Paul was still kind of like an evolutionary process of a good Christian guy, you know? Like he's still kind of climbing out of that primordial Judaic ooze, you know? And he's climbing up on land and he's getting his feet about him. He's standing up straight and he's, leaving all that stuff behind. That's how we think about some of these folks and some of these people. Is that they're kind of going through that evolutionary process. And that's really sad to me. And that's really disheartening and also dishonoring to Paul and the Jew that he was. We have three options now, okay? Number one, we either have to accept one of these three options. Paul was a Torah observant Pharisee, some of your ears just perked up, who stayed faithful to the mitzvot until the day that he died. Wait, Paul was a Pharisee till the day he died? Yes, he was. Paul was two-faced. We can accept Paul was two-faced and behaved one way in front of Gentiles and the other way in front of Jews. Or number three, we're just misunderstanding a lot of Paul's letters. What do Paul's contemporaries say about Paul? Peter says it. Bear in mind that our Lord's patience means salvation. Just as our dear brother Paul also wrote to you in the wisdom that God gave him. He writes the same way in all his letters, speaking in them of these matters. His letters, they contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorance and unstable people will distort as they do other scriptures to their own destruction. So right there, someone working shoulder to shoulder with Paul warns us, be careful how you interpret the letters of my buddy Paul, because he is hard to understand sometimes. He's like up here, you're like down here, okay? And the other thing too is you're stealing the Galatians' mail. You're reading a letter to the Galatians and you have no idea what's going on in Galatia. no idea what's going on in Galatians. You just went to their mailbox, you got their letter out, you read it, and now you're trying to make theological constructs out of this letter that you stole. That's dangerous, and Peter says it's dangerous. So I'm going to submit to you that we are going with number three. We just misunderstand Paul's letters a lot. That he was true to the Torah, and he was not two-faced. I had coffee with a pastor one time, and I brought this up to him. He got, needless to say, he got really fired up over this. Because this was rocking his world, right? This was like shaking everything he believed about Paul. And he says, well, by going up to Jerusalem, he was just acting in the flesh. He shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have behaved that way. He was just kind of defending his own pride. Well, I was like, let's take a little trip to Acts chapter 20. And let's see if his flesh was leading him to Jerusalem. Because Acts chapter 20, verse 22, Paul's making a different claim. He says, and now, compelled by the Spirit. Ah, I am going to Jerusalem. So the Spirit is taking him to Jerusalem. And he knows, they even tie him to a chair and they say, this is going to happen to you when you get there. I don't care. I got to go. The Spirit is compelling me to go. Yeah.
I actually heard somebody say one time that you should have tried that Spirit.
Ooh.
Can you believe that?
No, I can't. It's really sad.
Well, that's
stubborn right there.
How did that pastor respond when you showed him this?
I don't remember. I just don't remember.
He never accepted what you had to say.
No, no.
It's hard to change.
I don't
change.
Know.
It is.
It's that deconstruction process.
Yeah.
And it's a painful process. Sometimes it's easier to build than deconstruct. I'm finding out. So, will the real Paul please stand up? Acts 23. Some of you guys, maybe, wait, Pharisee? I didn't know that Paul was a Pharisee. Acts 23:6. This is where he's making his defense. But knowing that one part of the Sanhedrin consisted of the Sadducees, and the other part consisted of the Parashim, the Pharisees, which one was Paul? Paul shouted, brothers, I myself am a Pharisee. Is he using past tense?
No.
Uh-oh. I myself am a Pharisee and the son of a Pharisee. I'm on trial concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead. Ah, so he's splitting the Sanhedrin.
Nicodemus was a Pharisee,
yeah. Absolutely.
Joseph
of Arimathea was a Pharisee. Gamaliel was a Pharisee. So here's the Paul that we kind of construct, right? You know, this is Paul with his Gideon's New Testament there. But we have to remember that if we were to meet Paul, he very well may look more like that. Philippians 3:5, he says, he's showing his credentials. I was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. In regard to the Torah, I'm a Pharisee. Whoa. Wait, I thought Pharisees was like synonymous with hypocrite. No, it's not. Now, did Yeshua rebuke the Pharisees? Absolutely, yeah. Not because of their keeping of the law, but because of their hypocrisy in doing it.
Right.
He rebuked their hypocrisy, not their understanding of the Torah. And in fact, in Matthew 23, he says, as the Pharisees sit on the seat of Moses, I want you to do what they say, but don't do what they do, because they put heavy burdens on men and they don't even lift a finger. So, anyway. Acts 24:14-16. Let's look at that, and I think we're winding down here. Acts 24:14-16. And guys, I apologize. I'm not like a three-point sermon and an altar call. I just like to teach you the Word of God and the history behind it, and then you take it home, and I hope that compels you to be more godly and whatever. Take it or leave it, whatever you want to do with it. But yeah, thank you. Acts 24:14-16. But this I do admit to you. I worship the God of our fathers in accordance with the way, which they call a sect. I continue to believe everything that accords with the Torah. Wait a second. Whoa. This is happening after Galatians. And everything written in the prophets. And I continue to have a hope in God, which they too accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the unrighteous. Whoa. That's another paradigm challenger there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Indeed, it is because of this that I make a point of always having a clear conscience in the sight of both God and man. By Paul taking a Nazarite vow, which involves animal sacrifices at the temple. And we're talking 30-ish years after the death, burial, and resurrection of Messiah. He's offering animals in the temple. Oh, Paul didn't get a memo. Paul, Paul, that's been done away with. No, he didn't get that memo, apparently. So 10 years after writing the book of Galatians, he's there doing it. It creates serious doctrinal and theological issues that the mainstream church brushes off as a mistake on Paul's part or dismisses it as Paul being a Jew among Jews and a Gentile among Gentiles. That's mashugana.
Sure.
I think Paul was a man true to the Torah, true to his faith, and was consistent in that. So when I say Paul was a Jew and a Pharisee, does that create discomfort? If so, why? Our enemy, here's why, if that is great. Our enemy has sown very destructive seeds of anti-Semitism in our faith early on in the body of Messiah. And they now blossom into fully blown false doctrines.
Including in the way it was translated. There's a lot of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, in closing, Paul makes his defense. He says, I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple or against Caesar. So are we still falsely accusing Paul? And I would submit that there are a lot of people who are doing just that, falsely accusing poor Paul when he was just trying to do the right thing. Let's pray, and then we'll take about 5 minutes and do questions and answer, and then we'll eat some food. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for your word. I thank you for the life of Paul, who was willing to put everything on the line for the sake of your gospel, for the sake of Yeshua. He was still faithful to your word. Give us a zeal like Paul. Give us fidelity and faithfulness like Paul. Give us emunah like Paul. We're willing to put everything on the line, no matter what the cost, that we would be found standing faithful on your word. B'shem Yeshua, amen. So, questions, comments, 5 minutes, anything? Yeah, Tanya?
Oh,
you got to raise your hand, okay.
Yeah. I had both, but they were just down here.
I'm looking for hand raisers.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tanya.
I just have a quick thing. Is your teaching today, is it recorded if somebody wanted to hear it this time?
Yes, I record them all and put them on the podcast page. So, there are people who...
Is that on Facebook or is that on YouTube?
It's on iTunes, so if you have an iPhone, you go into the podcast app on your phone and you subscribe to Dothan Messianic Fellowship, but you can also get it on a website called podbean.com, and we post it to Facebook. We also email it out every week. Joanne emails it out in the weekly email, and there will be a link in there to the weekly teaching.
Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah, and it's obviously you can download it and do whatever you want with it. You can edit my voice to say different things. Yeah.
Is it Pro Tools one?
Yeah.
Can we make mems go with it?
Huh?
Can we make mems go with it?
Yeah, you can, any other questions? Jim?
I think the temple destruction is the big issue. And I think that's where people go awry.
Yeah.
Because they say, oh yeah, Paul was being observant because of the temple. But then after the temple, things change. At least that's what they want to say. So the real question is, what happens to the apostles after the temple? Do we see them still being observant after that time? And I think that's where we can bring a lot of clarity to things. Because the real misunderstanding is when the temple goes down, then what?
Yeah.
Right? And that's where I think...
We lost a lot when we lost the temple.
Yes, we did.
And we are a temple-based faith.
Yeah, and I think that's where the kind of the divide or the demarcation between how they lived in the first century as followers of the way and being observant, and then, oh, no temple, we don't need it anymore.
Yeah,
and
all this let's start a new religion.
Exactly, and I think that's where the big issue lies.
Well, here's the thing.
Wouldn't you say that? Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. We think about animal sacrifices as like bloody, gory, like carcasses being thrown all over the place and blood everywhere. But think about it. First of all, it wasn't the case. But an animal is going to die. What are the options for an animal to die? How can an animal die?
Predators.
You know, predators, I mean, what kind of death is that? Like, you're getting older and you're slower, you know, and you're going through a field or something, and it's night, and a series of wolves rip you to shreds.
Or disease.
Right? It's a violent death, isn't it?
Or disease.
Or disease, and you slowly starve or thirst to death as an animal.
Or lack of food.
Or someone comes along and hunts you down and kills you, right?
Or
with like an arrow or a club or something like that.
Lack of food and water.
So, but look at all these ways that an animal can die compared to the temple, You go in there, and a priest takes a very sharp object and slits that animal's throat. Before it can even feel any pain, it goes unconscious. And then it's offered to the Most High God. I mean, think in terms of options. If I was a lamb, I'd say, okay, wait, I'd weigh this out, ripped to shreds by a wolf, hunted down and hit with a club or a rock or an arrow, or my throat slit and I offer to the God of the universe. I'm going to go with that one, you know, and then these priests are going to feed themselves. You know, like that's, I would go with that option. But if we think about it, it's like the temple is so barbaric and all this stuff. But, you know, I don't know, it's not that barbaric. But did I see a hand up?
I was going to say, I think Revelation 12:10 is it? Answers the question about observance post-divinity.
Okay, Revelation 12:10.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Not only that, yeah. There's such a big protocol about keeping it clean.
Yeah.
Clean up as soon as the offering was made and all that.
Yeah, very sanitary environment. Yeah. Yes.
My comment was, or just was going to make sure that I was correct in my understanding. When Paul had his head shaved away from the temple, he had 30 days to present the hair because it would actually go under the altar for the burnt offering.
From my understanding, you needed to shave your head there in the temple precinct itself. Yeah, or else it wasn't a viable ending. And the Nazirite vow, by default, was going to be 30 days long at a minimum. So I don't know. He may have taken it and may have put it in a little Ziploc bag and then taken it to Jerusalem. I just don't know. But yeah. Some people will say that that's a Nazirite vow, but I'm just being honest and saying I can't really prove that he was doing
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vacuum sealed.
Yeah.
I just heard that as an explanation.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very possible explanation. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else?
Vacuum sealed papyrus.
One over here. Yeah, Patrick. He did this about 10, possibly even 20 years after Galatians was written. Yeah, yeah. That's in this slide. Anybody else? All right, we'll say the blessing over the juice and then and the bread together. We're going to eat in here because I think the flies are crazy out there. It's like a plague this year. Flies.
Yeah.
We got a lot of them. Well, Keith got a lot.
Keith. Good. Well, between Keith and...
Kyung Hee. Yeah.
But we took a lot of them home with us.
The spies are like, they're back this morning. All right, we'll say the blessing over the juice together.